and you just take it on for a bit, because I wonder whether it might just be that I need to reboot something, because it's like super slow right now. You can see it's like I'm kind of in stop motion, aren't I?
Yeah, but you look fine. It's not that bad. It's barely noticeable.
Can you hear me okay? I mean, is that actually all right? You can.
Sounds great.
All right, cool. All right, everybody. Welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. We're in a kind of a newish time. So this is 4 p.m. in the UK, 5 p.m. CST for the troopers in Europe that are still kind of paying attention to this rather than the weekend. And we'll bring it to you like we do every Friday. It is episode 131. So I'm delighted to be here. Particularly because we've got a special show today. We've got a welcome back a good friend of ours, a good friend of the communities, someone who I think all of us know and respect, Kevin Wheeler, the founder of the Future of Talent Institute. And normally we have a panel where we have a lot of people kind of casting their opinions, but today I wanted to give Kevin plenty of time to go through his theories, because I think he is one of those people that we should all pay very close attention to. So before we kick off, I just want to make sure that we're all right in terms of the AV. I'm pretty certain we're not very good on video because I can see myself looking super, super stop motion here. But can you tell me firstly whether you can hear me okay on the chat stream, please, on Crowdcast? I think, cross fingers, you can. Just let me know if you can hear me okay. We should be broadcasting this also on LinkedIn. I do wonder whether LinkedIn might just be causing me some grief in some way. If you can hear me there, give me a thumbs up, give me a thumbs down, let me know. And we're also out on Facebook as well. So in the Facebook group, or shall we say in the Meta group, we are in Meta on Brain Food over there. If you can hear me there, give me a thumbs up, let me know. Okay, I think some of us can hear us. By the way, if I'm looking a little bit kind of stop motion, what I might do is actually kick myself off, let Adam sort of say his bit and continue the show and then come back a bit later. I hope that's going to be okay because I really find this a bit annoying. But anyway, I want to welcome back Adam Gordon to the show because it's been like 4 weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it could be 4 weeks. I was thinking when you said this is episode 131 or something like that, I must have done about 80, 70, maybe 70, something like that. Anyway, thanks for having me.
I mean, you're definitely there. Like, what every four we do, you're there for three of them at least. And the only circumstances where that changes is if you're, you know, busy shopping or something, or where there's like, you know, a topic that I don't think you're interested in, or possibly where, you know, we've got a sponsor stepped in, they want to actually, you know, take on a bit of the work. So sometimes that happens. But yeah, it's been 4 weeks, so it's been good to see you, man. That's awesome.
Yes, thank you very much. Really excited to be here.
Cool. And actually, to speak in the sponsors, I want to draw attention to one of our really amazing and consistent sponsors this year. They've actually been one of the businesses that I think everyone in Europe and beyond have been talking about. And this is a German company called Personio. I'm sure you've all heard of Personio by now. They're a kind of a combined HRIS, ATS type of back office, all-in-one HR and people management system. And they've been amazing simply because I think it's always been historically very difficult for a German-based business to break into different countries outside of the DACH region. But Personio seem to have definitely started to do that. And also their fundraising has just been insane. Over the last, you know, 12 months, I think they've raised twice and it's into the multiple millions. So they're one of the European unicorns out there. And they've been fantastic as a sponsor for Recruiting Brain Food. They've asked me to share a link to their demo page. So if you want to go and sign up and check them out, this may be something you want to do if you're thinking about a new wave people management system. Think about payroll, think about holidays, think about managing the newly diversified workforce, you know, gig workers, permanent staff, interim staff. Personio, I think, are one of those new wave companies that are trying to say, you know what, for this new ecosystem of workers, we're going to be the tool that's going to help you do that rather than have you jump around to different things. So anyway, that is them. Let's get on with the show real quick, Adam. The topic of the show, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this. is about future fit talent leaders. And this is actually inspired by a lot of the writing that Kevin has been doing, which has always been future focused. But in recent days, he's been talking about how that impacts HR and TA and what we need to do actually to maintain our future fitness, particularly if the world of work is changing. Companies are starting to look at different types of worker into the company. What do we as recruiters need to be doing? Any thoughts on this topic yourself, Adam? What are you thinking when you, you know, cast your eyes 5-10 years down the line? What does HR and TA need to look like in that time frame?
Well, I remember talking on stage at SOZU, the sourcing summit, a couple of years ago, and I looked out at 300 sourcers and told them that the jobs that they're doing today don't need to exist. And what they need to do is become data analysts and nurture marketers. And, you know, that's just one small example of how technology process, the shifting workforce, and a lot of things are impacting the kind of skills we need to apply to our jobs today in talent acquisition. There's a huge amount changing, and we need to consistently look for inspiration from the worlds of marketing and the worlds of technology. It's a very, very exciting subject.
That's, you know what, I'm surprised you didn't get thrown off the stage there. I mean, SOZU is like 100% sources, man. So if you turn up and start saying that they've got no work anymore, I don't think that's a very good idea, mate.
I was in my kilt and I had my ski and dew down my sock, so I was armed just in case.
For folks who don't know, a skean dhu is a dagger. It's a knife, isn't it? That Scottish people are somehow permitted to wear. As long as you got a kilt, you can wear this dagger around. Ridiculous. Anyway, I'd be interested in your thoughts on here, folks. Like, what are the skills that recruiters are going to lose going forward in the next 5-10 years? Because there's some skills we've already lost. Like, for instance, cold calling used to be like the primary skill all recruiters need to have. 15-20 years ago, if there was one skill you needed to have to be a successful recruiter, it was be able to pick up the phone, dial 9, and actually speak to somebody. That, I don't think, is anything like a top 10 skill anymore. That's fell out of the top 10. You know, at one point in time, that was the number one skill that determined whether you could do the job or not. Now it's not there. I think we're in this similar sort of a period of change. So what are the skills do you think we're going to lose that we're currently valuing now? 10 years time, are they still going to be useful to us? Adam reckons sourcing is not going to be anything like as useful. Probably because I think AI is going to do a lot of that sourcing effort, I assume. Maybe we'll be monitoring people a lot better in terms of their sentiment. You know, you don't have to do all of the touch work early on to figure out whether people are interested in chatting with you or whatnot. I think so. Anything that takes kind of like trying to interrogate a system, you can imagine a software doing that better and more efficiently than human beings. So what are the skills we're losing? What are the skills we're gonna need? You're right, Adam. We should review the brain food. Totally forgot. This is why we need to have a back channel. I'm still very disturbed, by the way, by this pixelation. But okay, give us 3 things whilst the crowd think about these future skills that we're going to need. Give us 3 things from last week from a newsletter that you thought was interesting.
Right. So the Future of Work report from Talent Alpha, which is a talent intelligence platform, I believe, was really interesting. There was a lot of things in there, and they majored on the concept of A3 working, which is a kind of method for collaboration, which I think came out of Toyota originally. And it's all about problem solving and decision making, and how do we work differently now that we're probably operating in different locations and, you know, across different time zones and all that kind of thing. And we're much less likely to be in the same room brainstorming things and whiteboarding things together. So I really enjoyed that. Big, high-value piece of content, well worth downloading and taking a look at.
You know what? Talent Alpha are a really interesting tech business as well. When I first, I don't know where, I think I might have came across them at the same time you did, because we were at... it might have been Web Summit or it might have been HR Tech or something like this. I can't remember. But they've got a really interesting platform, which is trying to solve this problem of excess capacity that all of us have at times. So in other words, companies were not maxed out all of the time, but we always have some redundant capacity just in case we get a big order or we get something breaks down or something. We need to have that redundant capacity. But some of the times it's sitting there idling. And what Talent Alpha are trying to do is to say, you know what, we can actually find a way to pipe that talent to people who need it right there and then. And it's all software engineering talent as well. So super interesting. Great report, free to download. So check it out. A3 is like anytime, anywhere, any place. It's basically talking about distributed working, something you should know about as well. Bas, I think you're right. Yes, it was Unleash. I agree it was. Yeah. It was probably Paris. Yeah. Okay, give us a couple more, Adam.
I really enjoyed the article about is I'm going to speak American here. Is college worth it? So of course, right. what we in Europe would call university, is university worth it? And it said that on average, the net, it measured it in terms of like ROI from going to university. And it gave, and it said the average net gain is $320,000 or something like that. It said 3 out of 4 engineering like courses will net you more than $500,000 over the course of a career. And then there's others which actually could have even a negative impact. It said in the summary, it said that the biggest factor on this is what in America they call your major, which I think in other, the rest of the world terms means what you actually study. So I think that might be true. What you study might make a big difference, but I don't personally believe it makes a big difference, as much of a big difference as you and how you manage yourself and how you manage your career and, you know, your behaviors and all that kind of thing. I think you as an individual are much, much more influential over your earning potential compared to what you've studied at university.
I think that's a very UK way of looking at it. And I think you're right. I agree with it as well. In the UK, it's like study anything you want, just do well. And then you know what, you're into a graduate scheme and then you're going to be okay. I think the US may have a similar kind of vibe, but their differences, they have like massive student debt. So what they're talking about is, look, you actually need to really be careful about your selection of direction really early on, because if you emerge from university with like hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, then you may never be able to pay that away. And it's not like the student loans we get here, which is kind of like a thing you never have to pay. I think student loans is like super low interest. It's like 0.1% interest. I forget what it was, but it's very, very low. And you don't pay it until you hit a certain earnings rate. And when you do pay it, you've got like 80 years to pay it back or whatnot, like super long. I think in the US, the interest rates are actually rather high. So it's like, okay, you may emerge from college experience 3-4 years or whatever and have like hundreds of thousands of debt that you're paying 3-4% interest or whatever it is. Any US friends here, by the way, let me know what the interest rate is for student loans in sort of post-college. I'd be very interested to know what that number is. And then suddenly you're getting crushed with pressure. Because how are you meant to pay that off if you've studied fine art or something and you've got a job at a museum, which is all well and good, should be a totally viable career, but it's paying you 30K a year. You know, you're never going to do it. As simple as that. You're simply never going to do it.
It links into another article which said one in three
5.19%. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
6%. Wow.
Oh, okay. My good Lord. That's like loan shark level, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge amount.
That's crazy.
I wonder if it ties into another article from the Brain Food, which showed that 1 in 3 Americans lie on their resume.
I'd be lying on my resume if that was the case.
No, you definitely lie my ass off. Just so everybody is aware, Hung Lee attended what is officially the UK's top university, St. Andrews University. Better than Oxford, better than Cambridge. I, on the other hand, would have to probably go with 1 in 3 Americans and lie and say, studied computer science at Stanford.
You know what? The lying now makes sense because I think it was Bass that shared this.
I forget, maybe
it was Bass that shared it.
It was, yeah.
But it was all about like one in three Americans actually lie on their resume. And basically, the most significant lying was education and tenure. So how much experience you have. But given some of the numbers people are talking about here, 11% interest, holy crap, I would be lying my ass off to get a job. You can't expect me to be honest with that. That's like, I'm shocked. I knew it was a big number, but I didn't realize that the repayment terms were so aggressive. I mean, how is a person meant to even pay that? Obviously, you can't. I mean, it's not designed to be paid, to pay 11% on a six-figure loan. I mean, that's ridiculous. Okay, let's go on.
Yeah, just one more, which was the one from the Chinese sociology journal, which was about, they call it the age position effect. Mm. I think it's also called the relative age effect. It was famously covered in Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers. And I think it was in Freakonomics as well. It was mentioned in this. But specifically in relation to sport. So the theory here is if you're born later in the academic year, so you start and you're the youngest in your class at the beginning, I mean, by the time you go to school at 4 or 5 years old or whatever, you're not as well developed as other kids who are, you know, maybe a full year older than you. And therefore, in certain types of things, you're going to get streamed quite quickly. And the Canadian Ice Hockey League is a very good example. Like, half of the people were born within half of the professionals were born within like a 3 month period or something like that, because they got streamed from age 4 because they were the biggest in the class, basically. But this impacts on every aspect of life. And that was another really interesting article. So thank you for sharing that one.
It's stunning, isn't it? Because here's another thing, like it's a casual thing that I'm sure the people who first designed public education have thought about. Let's obviously organize kids according to age, and we'll do it in terms of years. But there's a very big difference from a kid that is nearly 6 compared to a kid who's just turned 5. You know, that is a person that is like physically, mentally, all this type of stuff different. And if you're always going to be the youngest kid in class basically means you're always going to be the smallest, always going to be less physically mature, less mentally mature in a general case. And that's got to have implications in terms of your self-perception, your self-confidence, how you negotiate with other people, you know, all of these characteristics that we now understand is important for career progression. You might have learned all of the wrong things at school because you're trying to just basically survive it. You know, if you're in a class or any kind of school, we know there's hierarchies going on. We know that, you know, kids are like any kind of animal, you know, they're going to have a status situation going on and what have you. You're the youngest kid every time. That may be very, very tough. So again, it blew my mind that. And I thought, you know what, we need to completely rethink a lot of things we're doing. Because it could be a lot of the people that we are saying, a mediocre achiever or mediocre performer could just be the youngest kid in class. Do you know what I mean? Could be it.
It could be. Maury's just told us that her son's a late birthday, but he's 6'9".
Well, that's a very tall child, Maury.
That's an outlier.
Yeah, what is in the water up there? But yeah, I think we can agree that's the outlier.
same height as Tyson Fury.
Well, that's a very large human being. I think most human, that's like in the top 0.1%, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely pro athlete level. So, yeah, that's great. Okay, we've got to get on with it. Let's bring Kevin on. He has hopefully got his coffee ready, and he's ready to join us. I think Kevin's been on the show before. I can't remember when it was, but it certainly wasn't recently. So I'm really pleased to bring him on to the show. And hopefully we're going to have better AV than I am here, and we're going to be okay. Interesting about, you know, like when kids should be going to university and stuff. Definitely. I by the way, Colleen, I absolutely knew kids that went in too early that weren't ready for it. And actually, university, I would say, really ruined them. You know, they weren't able to cope with that dislocation from, you know, home social groups and stuff like this. It was very tough. There he is, Kevin Wheeler.
Well, hello. Good morning.
How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing well. And by the way, I was second youngest in my class.
You were the second youngest in your class?
Youngest.
Second youngest.
Hasn't stopped you, Kevin. So there's always hope for everybody. Kevin, I think everyone in the industry knows you. But for the people who don't, who may not know you and coming across you for the first time, would you like to quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Sure. I run the Future of Talent Institute, which has been around for about 20 years. And we try to look at the trends that are having an impact on recruiting and learning and development over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. We don't have any crystal ball. We just try to track trends and talk to lots of people and kind of collect the data about what's going on out there. And from that, try to make some predictions about what is potentially going to impact the world of people in TA and learning and development.
You know what, Kevin? I think you're being a little bit immodest. I know no one likes to be a future teller, but I've got to be honest. If you go back on some of your writing, you know, go to 5, 10 years back and stuff like this, you've got it more. You've got a lot of stuff right. You know, particularly as to the evolution of how companies might work, where, you know, we can see maybe they'll start crunching down into core people and then surrounded by an ecosystem of people that might be interacting with them in a not exactly full-time way. I think you were the first person that brought that to my attention. That was several years ago. So, and that we're seeing right now with COVID-19, post-COVID-19, should I say. Kevin, let's dive into the topic. We talked just as we began it. There were certain skills that recruiters or TA folks prioritize today, but we think 5, 10 years down the line, you know, it's going to drop out of being an important part of the job. And I compared it to cold calling. You know, back in, you know, 20 years or so ago, you could not do the job of recruiting without actually being a skillful cold caller. If you couldn't do that part of it, you would not in the industry. Yet now, I think that's no longer even a top 10 job, the top 10 skill set. It's not something that is even significant. Do you see any skills that currently recruiters value that you foresee, you know what, in 5, 10 years time, this is also going to be dropping away from the top 10?
Well, probably almost all of them. Okay. I really think that we don't fully appreciate the speed that computational analysis, AI, is taking over everything that we do. I don't think we appreciate that. It's exponential, and we're not very good as human beings at understanding exponential change. But, you know, what looks like nothing today, tomorrow looks like, wow, what happened? And that's really what I think is happening in recruiting. You know, we've looked at, you know, we're piddling around with, you know, automated assessments and video interviewing and, you know, automated sourcing and chatbots. And, you know, we kind of all look at this as just sort of little, you know, yeah, they're nice things to have. And, you know, some people are going to do it. I don't think we appreciate that they're going to take over our world. And, you know, more and more organizations and companies are starting to put this stuff together, integrate these various tools into single tools. It's just going to suddenly appear in the horizon and blow us out of the water, basically. So, you know, if you're really focusing on improving your interviewing skills or your sourcing skills or your Boolean algebra, writing Boolean equations or whatever, I think you're just, you're wasting your time, because those are not going to be future skills that are of great value. They may be valued today. You may be able to parlay them into a salary today, but that's not going to get you very far 5 years from now or 10 years from now.
Yeah. Kevin, okay. Go ahead, Adam.
Kevin, I wonder if you talked about some like point solutions, for example, that we are piddling about with, I think was the term that you used, like sourcing tools and chatbots and things like that. But I wonder if behind the scenes, you detect that these organizations are entering the market with these sort of single-use solutions, but actually behind the scenes, they are collecting vast amounts of data, and they do actually appreciate the pace at which things will be changing, and they are preparing for that, or not?
I think the technology companies do, for sure. I think the people in those do. I don't think most recruiters do. I don't think most recruiters have a clue. I would say that 80% of recruiters are not technically very literate. That's, I wouldn't expect them necessarily to be technical gurus. That's not their job. It doesn't surprise me, but I don't think that most recruiters are really fully aware of what's potentially coming. You know, I think it's kind of like, you know, you don't see the tsunami because right now the shore looks okay and the water looks nice and, you know, I'm still dabbling around swimming. And tomorrow you're going to be swept into the you know, forest. So, you know, I think it's just one of those things that technology companies, I think, are aware of it. I think a lot of developers are aware of this. AI people are clearly aware of this. But, you know, I think HR, I just read an article last week and I tried to find it before the show and I couldn't locate it. But just saying, how are HR and recruiters perceived by senior leadership? And it was really, really bad. I mean, they are not perceived as really adding any value hardly at all to the organization. And when you see this, you combine that with the decreasing cost of computational power and what you can get for your money, eventually it's inevitable that these guys are going to make decisions around technology that ultimately have a big impact on HR and recruiting.
How does that manifest, Kevin? I mean, let's assume what you say is correct. And we go back to examine some of the critiques of that argument, because there are critiques of that position. But let's assume your position is correct. How does it actually manifest? Let's say there is a company that has implemented a technology solution that is going to make recruiters, in many respects, obsolete in terms of their contribution to the business. What does that mean exactly? Are you saying that a software is going to do the hiring, or are you going to say we're going to stop hiring because, you know what, the software is going to be able to do what the person, you know, do the activity the person we previously would hire to do? How does it actually transpire within the context of a company?
What I'm really been looking at a lot recently is the what's going on in the RPO world. And I use that as sort of a bellwether. In the RPO world, the good RPOs, the two or three large best ones, have invested tons of research dollars into automation and are really, really focusing on building up their automated recruiting capabilities and then using their remaining staff to do more sales and other sorts of things that technology can't yet do. I think that's a pretty good example of what's going on. I think if you're a smart company, and I know two or three here in the US that already have gotten rid of all their recruiting except for a couple of people and have outsourced it all to an RPO. And the RPOs are leveraging technology heavily so that they can lower the number of people they need to be involved in the recruiting process. And the ones left inside the organizations are focusing on two areas primarily, graduate recruitment and executive sourcing. But everything else has gone out to an RPO for the most part. So I think that may be the model that we end up getting. You know, I don't think most companies are gonna invest in this technology. There's no way they're gonna do that. Senior leadership is not gonna spend the millions of dollars required to really completely automate a recruiting process for most companies. But they can go and hire an RPO that's already done that. And they're leveraging numerous clients to pay for that R&D. And so when you really look at it, I think the future may well be that RPOs become the primary source of people for organizations and not having internal recruiting functions.
That's a really interesting take, Kevin. What would you say about the, I mean, there may potentially be a conflict of interest there though, because there's only so many RPOs that can afford to do this investment. And as such, you might end up in a situation where, you know what, I can't use this company because they happen to be recruiting for one of my competitors. And, you know, who else do I go to in this point? So is there not an argument to say, you know what, certain companies are always going to residually have some function that's going to take this on because of market conditions rather than a technological impediment or as opposed to some sort of, you know, efficiency brought on by technology? It could simply be, you know what, the market for RPOs that are able to do this investment is simply not big enough at the moment to cater for this.
Well, I think that may be true right now, but again, we're talking about exponential growth and change here. And, you know, first of all, I'll say that I agree. Lots of small companies will always, or for a very long time, have physical human being recruiters, okay? Because that's going to be the most economical solution for them with low volume. But I'm talking about the majority of medium to large size organizations. And I think we've got some outmoded notions about recruiting. I think we've got this thing that I own people, that, you know, it's going to be, you can't take my people because I've got, these are my people. I think this is just really silly sort of arguments. You know, I mean, whoever's got the best skill is going to get hired. And I don't really care. So this whole thing about conflict of interest and all, to me, is it's real right now. I get that. I'm not saying it's not an issue right at the moment, but is it really a long-term issue? Is it really going to matter? Especially as we're going to be looking less and less, I think, to hire full people. We're going to be hiring skills. And I make a real distinction there that I want
some. Let me stop you there, Kevin. Let me stop you there, because I think that's an important distinction to try and reach. And that's actually one of the most important things I think you've been saying for a long while. What do you mean by not hiring the full person? Can you just expand upon that a little bit for us?
I think we're going to go into more of obviously the gig world, and much more of a consultant model, where I'm hiring you because you have a skill or a set of skills that I need right now to solve some problem that I've got. I don't need you for the next 20 years. I don't want you for the next 20 years, okay? I want your expertise right now. Number one, that expertise may be transitory. I may only need it for a short period of time. And then if I hire you as a permanent employee, I got to deal with you for the next 20 years when I don't really need you. So we've got a lot of things changing out there. I think we don't fully appreciate what's going on out there in the business world. The gig economy is real. The gig world is real. It's going to grow. We're going to have these complex ecosystems, I call them, of, you know, part-time temporary consultant contractors. Many of you in the UK are familiar with Charles Handy, I'm pretty sure. Management philosopher who's, I think he's still alive, but he's extremely old right now. He's written a number of books, but he created what he's called the Shamrock Organization concept. And he did this in the 70s. He was just 50 years way too early. But the Shamrock Organization is actually happening right now. And that means you've got a small core of permanent workers who really are not necessarily experts at anything. They are generalists. And surrounded them is this ecosystem of contractors, consultants, vendors, strategic partners who deliver whatever services they need. We're starting to see this with Apple as a good example. They don't make anything. Everything is made with a strategic partner in China. Okay, they just design stuff. So, you know, this is just slowly sort of, we're beginning to see it. But I think this is just going to grow really quickly.
Kevin, can I ask you about I agree with what you said about, you know, that middle level is probably going to end up with the RPOs and the recruiterless type tech solution. And you said the bit that will remain in-house is the early careers and exec level. I can understand why exec level, but I'm interested to know why you think early careers remains in-house and remains like humans involved in it, you know, and that kind of thing.
I think it's a transitory thing right now. The reason I say that is because that's what's actually happening right now. Yeah. I think people in recruiting want something to do. Yeah. So they figure that focusing on that entry level is a good place to start. You know, I'm not sure that will be an enduring trend. I don't see any reason why RPOs can't do that as well. And the way we do college recruiting is obsolete anyways. So it's another whole topic.
Yeah, I think I've got an answer. I mean, I think I know why this is, but be interested to know at the other end, exec recruiting, in-house exec recruiting, what's the future for that? Why is that remain in-house? And yeah, what's the difference?
I think it's really just because senior execs want control and they want visibility and they want, you know, almost hands-on access to what's going on there. And they have their trusted headhunters or their internal team that does that. So it's an artifact. Okay, it's not a necessity. I think it's just a psychological thing, really, that's going on. I don't want to trust that to an RPO. It's too critical.
It's a red carpet experience that everybody on both sides wants. Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite powerful, though. I mean, we can't underestimate that. Sometimes we can look at organizations or companies as like completely rational, optimizing collaborations. But in fact, they're social organizations with all kinds of agendas in there. And there will be kind of reasons why certain decisions are made without it necessarily referring first to what is most efficient or what is most rational. That we made based on, you know, a lot of social considerations. And in fact, one of the phenomena that we see that's really quite interesting is this role that organizations or companies might have in terms of their contribution or lack thereof or their future increased contribution to the social good. Now, if that's kind of becoming a thing, you know, we talk about stakeholder capitalism now. We talk about, you know, a company that's profit only is no bueno. This is a toxic business because it only cares about the bottom line. What is the impact of, if you like, a social requirement pulsed into the company sector and the employer sector? Would that not kind of, how do you think that impacts the calculus of things, Kevin? Or do you think it's just a temporary kind of scenario, a temporary conversation we're having in this media cycle that ultimately is not going to be persistent?
You're really talking about economics and philosophy here, and you know, if we, and capitalism, if you really look at capitalism, it's not about social good. It's not about being nice to people. It's about making a lot of money. And I think that's kind of what we forget when we have a capitalist world. You can't have everything in one package. And when you have a truly capitalist world, as we do in America for sure, and the UK to some degree, and Europe as well, but maybe on steroids in the US, it's Facebook is a great example. It's about making money. It's not about being socially nice or being good to people.
No, Kevin, I realize that, but we can also not deny that there's been a huge wave against a pushback against that situation. Yeah. What I'm trying to say is that pushback real and is it going to be persistent? Or does capitalism prevail, I guess? Does naked capitalism prevail in the end? Well,
I think you're asking the $64,000 question, okay? Does capitalism prevail or does social good prevail? And I don't have an answer for you there.
Kevin, I don't.
You know,
probably no one does. And I'd be interested to know if everybody who's listening to this, like, what are your thoughts on this particular point? Do you think companies sort of should have a sort of a social agenda, or do you think actually they should just be what they are set up to be, which is, you know, profit making entities? I mean, most companies right now were created for that purpose. But they're now getting kind of pressured to say, you know what, we're doing this as an additional thing or even as the main thing. And profit happens to be kind of a positive outcome from their activities. What do you think about this? Do you think this is going to be a persistent thing going on, or does the bottom line mean the bottom line? It's a $64,000 question, as you say, Kevin.
As a candidate, I think, it's a brilliant question, because as a candidate, if I'm applying for a job, or if I'm working in a job getting paid £50,000 a year and the company I work for is like an electricity reseller or something and its only purpose is to claim a bit of kickback from, you know, energy companies, and that's it, and its only purpose is to make money, I kind of almost feel like I'm earning $40,000 instead of $50,000. Whereas if I'm working for a company whose purpose is to, you know, feed homeless people, then I might feel like I'm earning 80,000 when in actual, you know, it's only 50,000 real terms. But it's all about the kind of uplift in social value that's attached to that.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Like, how persistent is it? How real is it? And ultimately, when push comes to shove, is that actually a decision people are going to make? Like, for instance, we like to state these things, but let's say the same job or the job was offered at 50k for the electricity company, but the social good company is offering for 45k. What's your call going to be? It's not straightforward. You got a family, you got a mortgage to pay, you got stuff to think about. So your decision can't be casual, because that extra 5K actually may be paying for someone's student loan, for instance. We talk about how excessive the college degrees were in the US. So, I think it's going to be really challenging. And I don't think, we're going to really be able to see this until we see actually a migration of labor towards companies that say this and that happen to have lower salaries. Now, that would be the proof to me. If people go towards social good at lower rate, then yeah, I guess that's the thing. But I suspect most people are going to say, you know what, I got to go for what's best for me. And we can't isolate our own kind of personal agenda to this. And we'll end up going for the top books for whoever. This is why banks make money. I mean, who the hell dreams of working for Goldman Sachs when they're a kid? No one does that. But there's a hell of a lot of people go and work for them in the end. There's kind of a slight delay in terms of how I'm going, so I believe there might be some sort of like a break there.
I think it's fine. Okay. I was just gonna mention, quite a lot of people want to work for Goldman Sachs, but it's like because they see other people driving a Rolls Royce who work there.
Yeah, after a certain period of time when status becomes the main thing for you. Like when you're a young kid, you're 5, 6, 7 years old, you have dreams of that. It's sort of, if you like, more innocent world of the view of the world. That's not your dream. It's only when you start seeing the haves and haves not divide, that's when you start saying, okay, I'm going to go where the haves are.
But there's another.
Let me address. Go ahead, Kevin.
There's another question here that, you've got companies, big, very rich companies, and they're doing tons for social good, theoretically. I mean, they're donating all kinds of money to various ends. They're cleaning up homeless camps and so forth. How much is enough? How much good do you have to do as a company before you're considered to be socially good? If I give, $100 to charity, or I give $100 million to charity, am I better than you because I gave more? So, Amazon, Apple, all these companies are doing tons of stuff for good. But I don't know that they're perceived as being good. And, how much is enough? And where do you draw the line? I mean, you got millions of questions around this issue, right? Millions of them.
Yeah, we don't know. But I think it's a debate we'll have maybe at some other point. Let's try and refocus back on the journey of TA and HR. Because we've got a bunch of people obviously watching this and thinking, okay, Kevin said all of these things, that's all well and good, but what do I need to do in order to equip myself for this future world? Do you have any recommendations or advice for someone listening to this who agrees with your perception of how a significant technology will be in terms of impacting the people's job? In which case, what would you recommend they do aside from, get another job? Let's say that's a sort of an option they can pursue. But if they stay within the discipline, what do you think are the sorts of skills they need to be picking up? I don't think
I've lost you guys. I don't know what happened. Now you're back.
Did you hear us? Let me just repeat, Kevin. You might have missed the last 30 seconds there. Basically, what I was saying is, okay, let's assume the technology is going to be hugely disruptive to recruiting and HR, in which case I'm in HR and in recruiting right now. What should I be doing in terms of equipping myself to be competitive in this future? What is the place where I'm going to basically give myself the longest runway and the best chance?
I think focus on, guess what I'd call, what I think what Adam talked about at the beginning, some of those broader human skills. How good are you at negotiation? How good are you at communication? How good are you at analytical thinking? How good are you at looking at data and analyzing data? How good are you at influencing senior leadership? How good are you at doing some of these things that aren't necessarily focused directly on the recruiting skills that we traditionally look at, but are the broader and softer and I think ultimately more useful and transferable skills that you're going to need to, as if technology takes over, what are you going to do? You're going to be negotiating, you're going to be influencing. Those things are a long way away from AI doing. So those are the things that we're going to need people to continue to do. We're not going to need them to do things like find people in, you know, interview people, you know, process all the paperwork, onboard them. All that stuff is going to be automated.
Yeah, I think so. I think more or less everyone would agree on the administrative function. I think most of us underestimate how much administration goes into the work of processing people, if you want to use that term. You know, there's a lot of basically emailing of documents. And even when you're dealing with HR departments, I'm dealing with HR departments all the time, there's like lots of backwards and forwards. And it feels like, you know what, why is this happening? It doesn't seem that, you know, that it needs this amount of human eyeballs on this. It literally is a document. A computer can scan that and figure out what that means. Get it confirmed. I don't need to have like extra eyes on this. I think a lot of that admin can go. The stakeholder management, I guess, is maybe a good way to categorize a lot of those skills that you mentioned. You know, you're sitting in the nexus of a lot of things. Can you advise companies? Can you persuade? Can you kind of educate? Let's also not forget that, you know, when you're looking at the literacy of the HR and TA department when it comes to advanced technologies, we may not be super advanced, but I think there's many other departments that are also not super advanced. You know, you look at the managerial tier, Adam, I mean, I'm sure you agree. I mean, the people that we deal with all the time, you know, maybe coming from our generation and above without being ageist, of course, but, you know, there's going to be people that are very wedded to ways of working that are archaic. And maybe one of the things that recruiters and HR people can do is be the educational function in businesses to try and up-level the businesses in terms of being more technically literate.
Yeah, no, there's no... I don't deny that HR is the only department that needs to change, for sure.
I think we're losing Kevin, think, you know?
A little bit. I think we're somewhere in the middle. I mean, we're behind marketing. We're probably behind finance. We're behind a couple of other pretty well-established areas, but we're probably ahead of procurement and certain other things.
I disagree on finance, man. I mean, I think finance they're totally into Excel, and that's it. They stopped at Excel.
I don't know. Not true.
They don't know anything about AI, man. Finance is one of those departments that literally shouldn't exist at all. I mean, that's one of the most automatable systems around.
I think it has been. I mean, I think it has been. That's my point. Gone are the days of like teams of 5,000 finance people. It's like the finance teams are much smaller than they used to be.
But here's the thing, though. I mean, finance is still like has a tremendous political power within an organization, and that political power is not to be underestimated. They will end up sort of making decisions to preserve their position in that hierarchy. And that means a lot of the sort of obvious ways in which you might make a company efficient, I think, will be resisted by powerful political interests within a company, which I think might slow down the adoption of some of these phenomena. Okay, quick interrupt on this, guys. So to everyone here, if you've got any questions for Kevin, please fire them and ask a question section below. We're going to get to them in turn so everyone has the ability to get a fair hearing. So please do put your stuff in there. And secondly, let's take a moment and do something I want us to keep doing, which is to reconnect with everybody here. Kevin was talking about it. One of the best ways in which we could kind of securitize ourselves is to make sure we're very well connected and very influential within our own networks. So I'll go ahead and share your LinkedIn profile into the chat stream right now and make sure you connect with everybody who is there. Let us not be the bottleneck for this. Go ahead and connect with those people. Everyone who's watching this is thinking about the future fit of talent acquisition. These are people that you should also be speaking with after this show ends. Don't let this be the bottleneck. Go ahead and share your LinkedIn in the chat stream right now. I would share mine as well, but I've hit the limit already, and there's already a massive queue of people who think I'm really rude by ignoring. Like, there's not a polite way to not accept a LinkedIn request. It's simply, you know, ignore. And I think that gives bad signals to people if you do that. So I try not to ignore people. But there's no other way to interact with that person in a sensible way. So I've got to just go through LinkedIn and actually start deleting people and then create some space.
You have to purge, I'm afraid.
I can't safely do that. I mean, it looks like it's a very difficult thing to try because it seems like quite dangerous. Like the only thing, the way I've tried to do is simply by a basic search on random stuff and then picking out people that don't have pictures and then like deleting them. But there's no like super efficient way Tim Sanchez, quite correct. I think Irina Shameva has a technique. Aaron Lintz has as well, but they strike me as super dangerous because they're saying, right, what you got to do is export all your contacts into a CSV, delete all of them, then delete everything off LinkedIn, and then do the purge off platform, clean them all out on your CSV, and then re-import. And I'm thinking, yeah, that may just be a bit too high risk. So you can't do it within the platform.
You might as well just leave LinkedIn and start again.
Right. That's basically what the advice is. Like I see.
But that's building a database, though, isn't it? That's not yeah, really what it's intended for. So it depends what you're using it for. Everybody's different, aren't they? So
it's exactly, Tim, super high risk. What I might do is start actually deleting my friends because there's no reason for me to speak.
I was going
to
say that. You've got them on Facebook or somewhere else anyway. So
yeah, exactly. Everyone on Facebook, I just blast them out and then basically they can talk to me elsewhere. Okay, Kevin, listen, we're coming to the, we've got you back. Hopefully we're going to keep you here for the rest of the show. But before we kind of let go, can you give us a bit of an idea as to kind of which functions you think that will be persistent within the current activities that HR and TA are doing? Or do you think the function itself will disappear and will end up kind of merging in to some other function within a company that does a lot of this influencing type of work?
Yeah, I think it'll probably merge into something. I think HR and recruiting and learning and development emerge in something that is human related, that's related around influencing and so forth. I think many people will take on different roles. I think you're going to see a lot fewer HR experts and HR, you know, people like that, and recruiting experts. You're going to see a lot more generalization of these fields.
That's, you know, really interesting to connect it to L&D. I think a lot of people do think this as well, like people might end up migrating into companies purely or at least primarily for the L&D context of it. So in other words, you may be able to trade more effectively, more efficiently as a freelancer or gig worker or whatever it might be, trading on those skills. But if you're still on a growth path and one of your main things that you want to do is actually to improve your network, or one of the main things you want to do is to learn new skills, then that suddenly makes an employer a more attractive place to be. And then you can see the employers might respond by encouraging that development. And I guess HR, L&D, you know, that's a prime spot to do some of that type of work. And that also links in with internal mobility as well, especially for big companies, for instance. It's very tightly linked with skills development, internal mobility. So if people want to move to different skills, that makes sense that they then may move to different roles. HR or TA might fulfill a very significant function there. Kevin, any last words you want to give to the audience on this? Firstly, I think everyone should subscribe to Kevin's newsletter. It's a fantastic newsletter. I think it's one of the ones I read very regularly. Also one of the newsletters I promote in my newsletter quite regularly. So Kevin, I wonder whether you could just put a link into your Future of Talent Institute newsletter in the chat stream there, let folks understand where that is. And then they can subscribe. I highly recommend it. And whilst you're doing that, it would be great to know sort of a final thought from you with regards to, we don't want people to come away from this conversation feeling overly pessimistic. We want realism. We want people to understand, you know what, this is interesting. We need to take an interest. We need to deepen our knowledge as to what these mega trends will be. What's the final takeaway message you want to give to folks who just maybe joined TA for the first time or become a new person in HR and they're just learning about all this stuff right now? What's the message to those people?
I would say the primary message is broaden your skill set as much as you possibly can. Don't become so technically expert in some specific area of recruiting that you don't have other skills. You know, really focus on getting those skills of influence, negotiation, influencing, communication. Those are the key skills. That's what you should focus on. That's what's going to future-proof you as much as you can be future-proofed. You know, becoming an expert in sourcing or becoming an expert in interviewing, for example, those are transitory skills. They're good for a short period of time, but then they're going to go away. As Adam said at the beginning, sourcing is going to go away. There's no question about that. It's just simply a matter of when. And even if it survives, it'll only survive for a tiny few number of people, not the bulk of people that are doing it today. So, you know, really look at those things that technology is very likely to replace in the shorter term rather than the longer term. And don't focus on those. Focus on the other things that are going to last longer.
I just wanted to add to that.
Go ahead.
Tom's put a comment which says it's not pessimistic to embrace the future and ride the wave. That's absolutely thrilling. And that's exactly what I thought when you said, Hung, you know, we don't want to be too pessimistic here. I don't believe it's pessimistic at all. And I completely agree with everything that Kevin said. There are certain types of jobs which are going to evolve, and they're going to evolve in a very exciting way. And the rise of teams like talent operations teams, whose job is about connecting technologies and designing, you know, experiences and designing the processes. And then certain areas of recruitment marketing, where there's going to need a huge amount of human involvement in designing, you know, designing processes and designing experiences and things like that. There's loads of exciting jobs that are going to, you know, emerge within talent acquisition. So when I say sourcing is going to disappear, what I mean by that is the skills needed to find people, that's not going to be an important thing for the future. But somebody I know has just moved from IBM into another, where she led sourcing into another company, where her job is like head of talent innovation, head of TA innovation or something like that. So, you know, working out what is happening in the future and how are people interacting with companies now and all that kind of thing. And how do we adapt? You know, this is all real strategic stuff. So there's a lot of very exciting jobs which are going to emerge within our, you know, our discipline.
Yeah. And jobs that we can't even imagine today, you know, jobs that we don't even have any idea what they're going to be.
Well, actually, if the sharp-eyed viewers, I think Bass is one of these, kind of notices that I try and sneak one of those future jobs, like weird jobs, into every newsletter. And there's one coming up this Sunday, which is fantastic. It's one of those weird jobs that actually I want to do. But it's again, you look at it and you think, how is anyone actually paid to do this? But then you realize, actually, that's like damn important. And it's worth like, it's worth the entire value of the franchise for this thing to keep on going. It's amazing. I'll tell you what it is.
Give us a spoiler. Tell us the job.
The spoiler is, okay, so apparently there are people that are employed by fictional franchises in order to basically archive and curate the canon of those franchises. So in other words, when people do franchise, maybe Marvel Universe as an example, it's a multi-billion-dollar franchise. What you want to do to maximize that is to make loads of different films. They'll all cross over with films, with storybooks, with toys, whatever it is. There are people employed, and basically to make sure that there's no like radical crap inconsistencies that the fans are going to hate, that all of it stitches together. So they're almost like a fictional universe curator. They're the person that says, okay, we've outsourced this storyline to you, Adam, but you can't say this because that really contradicts the storyline that Kevin's going through. You can't write that. And they will say, you can't write that. You can't then write that and still maintain your piece of work as part of that canon. And I just think, you know what? That's an incredible job. would you even have ever believed that this exists? But it does apparently exist as a paid bit of work. So anyway, that's going into Sunday's Brain Food. Okay, folks, that's going to be the end of the show. So I want to thank Kevin Wheeler for coming on and giving us his wisdom. A fantastic newsletter to follow. Please do follow Kevin also on LinkedIn. I assure you it is worth doing. Kevin, you go and enjoy the rest of the day. Hopefully you and I will get the chance to catch up at some of the points, sir.
Hopefully maybe in person someday, huh?
Indeed, that'll happen. Don't worry, 2022. I'm excited.
Absolutely. All right.
Great. Kevin, he's such a smart guy, very interesting dude, and I'd really love to see him again. I think the last time he came to Europe was, again, 2-3 years ago. So we're going to have to make sure we do that, get him over here ASAP. Okay, that's about it, everybody. We're going to be back next week, I think, at the normal time. Oh, next week, we've got an amazing show. We've got an absolutely amazing show. Adam, you're going to love this. We've got the global talent marketing team from IBM. They're going to join us and talk about employee-generated content. It's going to be a fantastic show. Nick Thompson's joining us. We've got the content creation team there as well. They've got an amazing case study. And it was kind of me putting together the November schedule. It got me talking about this. Thought, you know what? We're just going to get IBM on there. They've got like a brilliant story. And we're going to see whether we can get some of the employees on as well. So some of these people who they've corralled in and they've got like now millions of YouTube views or whatever, we're going to get them on and they're going to tell us, okay, this is how we did that. So it's going to be a fantastic show. Follow the channel if you want to see more on that. Yeah, it's going to be next week. So we'll see you then. Cool. Right. That's it. Adam, thanks for persevering, mate. I really got distracted by the stop motion effect here.
Where are you?
I'm at home. I've just got a new screen. So I've realized I need to take my own advice, which is I've got to sit in front of a window in order to get better lighting rather than fiddle around with lights and stuff. So I've got this, I bought this thing on Amazon. It cost me, by the way, post-Brexit, it cost me an extra... how much it cost me? Yeah, it cost me an extra 30% on shipping fees as a result of us leaving the EU. So thanks, Brexit. So anyway, I got this, but I think it might be affecting the camera in some way. I don't know. But basically, it really distracted me with this in and out. So I just see myself like one of those 1970s, dinosaur movies. where it's like...
It looks fine.
Yeah.
I'm going to look... I'm going to look radically different on next week's show.
Beards off.
Well, it is the 1st of November on what, Monday or something. And what happens in November? Movember.
So what does that mean for you? Are you going to shave it all off and then regrow, basically?
No, I'm going to have a mustache.
All right, so the beard's gone and the mustache days, yeah?
Yeah, I did it 3 years ago, or 2 years ago maybe, and I got rid of the whole... No, three. It must have been 3 years ago. I got rid of the whole thing and then regrew the mustache, and it just took quite a long time. But actually, I think probably this time I'm just going to get rid of everything except for the mustache. So I told my wife I was going to do this, and she said, "What? Why are you going to do that?" I said, "I'm going to raise some money. I might raise like £100, something like that, for the charity." She said, "I'll pay you £200 not to do it." She then said, "If you grow one, I'll grow one." I was like,
"Oh my good lord!" I tell you what, I'd pay her £200 not to do that. It's like
we don't. Like, what are you going to do? Go in with a stick-on mustache or something?
Yeah, I tell you what. Let me know what charity you choose. Now I'll help promote that.
Movember is the charity, and
isn't that the campaign? And there's a charity it goes to or something.
Well, yeah, but I guess it's split across two things. I think it's prostate cancer and mental health awareness. So right, I'll work it out and I'll.
All right, share with me some link anyway, because I'll put that into the Monday newsletter. Okay, that's it. I'm gonna go. See you later, man.
Cheers. Bye.